It's December 5th, 2025. Just returned a couple days ago from India via 2 nights in Thailand. So I was gone for about 6 weeks, maybe a little over 6 weeks, and now back to pick up my duties once again. And I'm very grateful to the community who stayed behind and helped look after the monastery. And so took some members of the Sangha and the laity, and we did a India Four Holy Sites pilgrimage. And to do this from America is considered something difficult. And we actually did it, pulled it off, and it was a great success. And so now people are reintegrating, and the hearts and minds are changed based on this experience. And so that was definitely the intention behind it, is just to deepen one's faith and create a stronger foundation for practice. And for some people, it might be the only time that they ever get to do this. Some people might just get this opportunity once in their lives to, as a practicing Buddhist who has faith in the Buddha, faith in the Buddha's teachings, someone who's taken refuge in Buddha Dhamma Sangha and is practicing the precepts, to go to the Buddhist holy sites is a great blessing, great opportunity to be able to do that. And it creates a very strong foundation of faith and enriches the practice. And it's hard to know what it is going to be like just by looking at photos. You can't really pick up on the energy of each of these places. And but to actually be where the Buddha actually was in real life is a profound experience. And we started out by, I thought, well, if we're going via Thailand, then have to spend 10 or 11 days in Thailand and show some of the monks around there as well. So we started out with a bit of a trip in Thailand, a bit of a tour to some of our places, some of our monasteries in Thailand, and then met up with people in Bangkok. Most people met in Bangkok, and then we fly directly to Bodh Gaya. And some people went directly to India beforehand. And so we all met in a hotel, in the Dhamma Grand Hotel in Bodh Gaya. And it's a bit of a interesting thing that to go to where the Buddha attained enlightenment, it's a really crazy place. It's in Bihar, India. And India is already just so different in terms of a country, and about half the group had never been to India before. And so to go to this place, and where there's just, you see a different type of society than what we're used to. And it was really good to have these meetings, the Zoom meetings beforehand, get some advice from Ajahn Acholo, who is a veteran India Four Holy Sites pilgrim. And one of the pieces of advice he gave was just let India be India. Don't focus on the injustices or necessarily try to change anything or think that there's something wrong with it. India is just India, and no matter what you do, it's just going to keep being India, so might as well just surrender to it. So to go to Bodh Gaya, it's at the beginning of, there is a pilgrimage season. The cold season is the pilgrimage season. Can't really conveniently do a pilgrimage in the rainy season or in the hot season. It's just way too difficult. So we went at the very beginning of the pilgrimage season, just as it was getting going. And by the time we returned, it was getting really, really crowded. And it's an amazing place, Bodh Gaya. So I think of it as that you have this place where the Buddha attained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. You have this temple there that we call the Mahabodhi Stupa, or the Mahabodhi Temple. And inside of this temple is a very famous Buddha image made out of a very hard type of black stone, and it's called Buddha Metta. And so we started there, and then it just happens that you start there and you can do this loop where you go to these different holy sites, and not in order, but just based on their geographical location. And so we did have, at the very beginning, we had 2 nights in Bodh Gaya. So we arrived, and then going through India customs, and I won't go through everything here, but yeah, just going through India customs, and people had been briefed on this already. So our group just did so amazingly well. Everybody was being very patient and was expecting really a slow, difficult time. And yes, it was slow, and they have these ridiculous old fingerprint readers that seem to work for almost nobody. and you have to like put your fingers on it multiple times before it seems to work and keep wiping them off with alcohol pads. And then the person's telling you, you have to wipe your fingers off with alcohol pads and press harder and still not working. And then you have to do it at a certain angle. And it's just doesn't seem to make any sense. It's quite frustrating, but we all got through that and people were just fine. It was actually better than expected getting through customs. And the next day we had a full day in Bodh Gaya to go and pay respects to the Mahabodhi Stupa and to see Buddha Metta and just get our first real experience. We did go in evening the night before, but the first full day experience of going there and being able to sit in the morning time, do a bit of a morning puja. And then we were all set up on this really prime location. There's 50 of us. So 42 lay people, 9 monks, and then our tour guide, Yom Lek, who organized almost everything on this trip. And she has workers who spread out mats and put out cushions for everybody. So they're able to set up these demarcated areas for our group whenever needed. And so we were sitting. It's really pleasant and really wonderful to be sitting there. And then we had an opportunity to offer a robe to Buddha Metta. So there's a monk who spends his whole day in this chamber with this Buddha image, and people offer robes and he takes the robes and puts them on the Buddha image. And it's considered a great blessing to be able to offer robes to Buddha Metta. And so we went and did that and did some chanting in this kind of temple chamber. And we come out and then there was another group sitting on all our stuff. So there's another group of 50, a different country, and they were just sitting on all our stuff and they just took over our spot. Not only did they take over our spot, they were sitting on our stuff. They're like on our personal cushions, on our jackets, on our, like physically on our stuff. So, okay, this is interesting. And so I went and kind of forcefully pulled my sitting cloth out from under this person as they were doing their own chanting and puja. And everybody took it in stride, and that was kind of a good test to start the experience of being in India. And so I just said, okay, well, we just have to find another spot. And the expectation, we were getting ready to go back and meditate for an hour, but then there's this other group on our stuff. So everybody pulled their stuff out from under these people, and we went to another spot, and everybody took it in stride and had a really good attitude about it. So I thought, okay, this is going to be okay. This is going to work. And the next day we had 2 full-size tour buses, and we made our way to northeast from Bodh Gaya to Rajgir. And this place is formerly known in the suttas as Rajagaha. And it used to be the center where King Bimbisara had his palace in the center of the biggest state of India in the time of the Buddha, called Magadha. And this is a place where we can go up to a Vulture's Peak mountain where there's the Buddha's Kuti, the Gandakuti, where the Buddha spent 5 vasas. And so most people consider this a very powerful site. And this just happened. This is going to be one of the first, this is really the first place we were going. Also in this area is Nalanda University, which was started to be excavated, rediscovered about 100 years ago. It was the biggest university in the world at the time. And this is a university that was founded maybe a couple hundred years after the Buddha passed away and is in the home village of Venerable Sariputta. So a couple places at this Rajgir area, which is another very poor region of Bihar. And it was kind of our habit to, with this like 5, 6, 7, so 5 a.m., wake up, 6 a.m., breakfast, 7 a.m., get on the bus and do our morning puja, morning chanting on the bus. We had a microphone on the bus. And then it's only maybe, 2-hour drive to Rajgir. Get settled in our hotel. We went up. There was a walk up this mountain to where the first Buddhist council took place, headed by Venerable Mahakasapa, took place after the Buddha's Parinibbana. So we walked up there in the afternoon. Then the next day, we're going to go early to walk up Vulture's Peak, And this is a very popular location because not only is it the Buddha's Kuti, but just below the Buddha's Kuti, there's the cave where Venerable Sariputta attained arhatship, where in the Diganaka Sutta, where the Buddha was teaching Diganaka, and Venerable Sariputta was fanning the Buddha with from behind and reflecting on the teaching as it was being given, and Diganaka attained stream entry and Sariputta attained arhatship in that sutta. So there's that area where that happened, just below the Buddha's Kuti. There's also this Mahamoggallana cave, and there's an area where Mahakasapa would hang out. So there's a lot of sites on Vulture's Peak. But there's a down below at the bottom of the stairways leading up the mountain, there's a gate, and they open at 6 a.m. normally. And so we were there at 5:45 a.m. and thought, oh, well, we just have 15 minutes till opening. We might as well do some Etipiso chanting, where we do these Etipiso Bhagava, this homage to Buddha Dhamma Sangha, that we sometimes do it three times, nine times, 108 times, which takes a couple hours. But I thought, oh, we've got 15 minutes. We might as well just do some chanting at this gate. And as we all started doing the chanting, then the gates just opened 15 minutes early. And we just started, we continued chanting, but we started walking up the hill and there was nobody there. The guards decided to just, somehow we got the secret password and the guards just opened the gates and we got to go up early. And because we got to go in early, then we were able to do a morning puja and a 30-minute sitting of meditation up at the Buddha's Kuti on Vulture's Peak with nobody else around. And that is almost unheard of, to get the place to yourself. It's very quiet. And it was 30 minutes before the next groups started coming up. And then we were able to take some group photos and then walk down a little bit to allow the other groups to go into the Buddha's Kuti. And we were able to walk off to the side a little bit, do some exploration in that area before heading down, visiting the Sariputta Cave, Moggallana Cave, and so on. So that was kind of a very special experience. And we also, later that day, we went to Nalanda and did some more meditation. And already at this point, people were feeling very moved to be on this journey together. Yeah. A lot of gratitude already, and people having very powerful experiences of faith and gratitude and well-being arising. And from there, though, we had to do a very long drive. Then it was up to Kushinagar, which was about an 8 or 9 hour drive. And that's where the Buddha's passing away took place, what we call the Parinibbana, or the entering into the coolness. That's where the Buddha passed away at the age of 81 after a 45-year teaching career. So on the way, there's a place to stop. So we ended up having a meal we would eat at hotels, or there's like Thai temples that offer, you can get food there, or there's hotels. So there's various stops along this pilgrimage route. And Kushinagar is, in the time of the suttas, it's known as Kusinara. The names are still similar. And on the way, the halfway point is, now it's called Vaishali. In the time of the suttas, it was called Vaisali. And Vaisali is where the Buddha, say, relinquished the life faculty 3 months before he fully passed away. There's this event where he relinquishes the life faculty and decides that he's going to pass away. And that took place in Vaisali. Also, something that took place in Vaisali was where the Bhikkhuni order, the order of nuns, was founded 5 years after the Buddha's awakening. And the people who lived there were called the Lichavis, and they come up a lot in the suttas. And so there's monuments and Asokan pillars. About 250 years after the Buddha passed away, this King Asoka, spreading Buddhism throughout India, erected these pillars with Dhamma teachings and stone epigraphs on them, saying what happened at that site. And so we spent some time there. There's also Buddha relics. It's supposed to be actual bones of the Buddha that had been distributed to a monument there. And they had a new building that was built for them. And so we were able to go in and pay respects to what is supposedly actual original bone relics of the Buddha. So also, yeah, very, very nice thing to be doing. We continued on to Kushinagar. And we got in at like, I mean, at this point we're getting really absorbed into the experience of traffic in India. So it's combined, you have this faith coming up, going to these holy sites, and then the reality of just dealing with modern traffic in India. And we're in these big buses and drivers are very, very good. But there was also an election going on, in a general election in Bihar. So a lot of people out and about, and more traffic than usual, and some military out and about. And we got to our hotel at like, it was like 9:30 p.m. when we got in. And it happened to be Paddy Mocha Day as well, when the monks have to recite their rules of training. So just like today, we're at 3 p.m. earlier today, Ajahn Chunda recited the Paddy Mocha, the 45-minute recitation that the bhikkhus do every 2 weeks. And that was, we needed to do that in our hotel. And then I had agreed to give a talk to a online to a some of the monks, some monks that I know who were heading up a new Ajahn Chah branch monastery in India. And that night also happens to be that's the full moon of November. So that all these things were coinciding. One is Lompar Liam's birthday. Two is it's the full moon of November is considered the day of passing away of Venerable Sariputta, the Buddha's foremost disciple in wisdom. And then also it's the day we recite our rules of training. And also it's a day that we arrived very late at our hotel. So I had agreed to, at this new Ajahn Chah branch monastery in India, they were going to stay up late meditating. And I had agreed to give a talk to them, but I didn't know when we were going to arrive. So we're allowed to shorten our recitation of rules of training for various reasons. One reason is a time of transit, or if you're in transit or traveling. So we did like a 20-minute, you know, truncated Paddy Mocha recitation. Then it was about 10:30 p.m. And then I went and did this online teaching, which went until about 11:30 p.m. And I was falling asleep. We did a Q&A session, and I remember falling asleep during one person's questions. And I said, sorry, I fell asleep. Can you repeat the question? And then I was able to take a rest after that. That was a very, very long day. And then the next day, we were able to go to the what's called the Mahaparinirvana Shrine. In Pali, we say Nibbana, but in the Sanskrit, they'd use the Sanskrit name, the Nirvana. And there's like a housing with a large reclining Buddha. So when the Buddha's final passing away is depicted reclining on his right side, the hand under the head. And so there's a large image of a reclining, a rupa, a statue of a reclining Buddha in this housing area. And a lot of people find this spot to be very, very powerful and moving. And then behind it, there's like a round stupa monument for probably has some sort of Buddha relics enshrined in there as well. And we had a chance to offer robes, like where you drape robes over this reclining Buddha and do some meditation there and chanting and whatnot. But a lot of people very moved at this place, bursting into tears, not knowing why and not expecting to. It's very uncontrived, and it's all sorts of recollections coming up. And for me, I've been to these places before and I didn't feel strongly emotional, but I had some nice recollections of Nibbana coming up, just because this is where the Buddha is like laid down the khandhas, finally laid down the body. And this like the, when someone achieves enlightenment, it's considered the mind is enlightened, but the body still has bodily suffering. The mind doesn't have suffering anymore, but then the body still has suffering. So what we call the parinibbana, or the final nibbana, is where the body passes away and that form of suffering also passes away with the body. And just this idea or this recollection, this kind of, for me, kind of this sadness coming up of the Buddha passing away. And in the story, in the suttas of the Buddha's passing away, in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, talks about monks who were fully awakened and they weren't getting emotional at this, and they were equanimous. But then the monks who weren't fully awakened yet were bawling their eyes out and crying. And one of them was the Buddha's attendant, Venerable Ananda, and he can't bear it, and he's crying, and he goes and he's bawling his eyes out outside, leaning against a doorpost. And then Buddha has somebody go and get him, and he says, "Ananda, haven't I already taught you all formations are impermanent? How could it be otherwise?" And he's like, "Oh, all too soon, the light of the world is leaving. All too soon, the Buddha is passing away." And then when we were there, I didn't know that this was something people did, but apparently some Thai monks will, out of faith, they'll do a reenactment of Ananda crying and wishing the Buddha wasn't going to pass away. So when we were there, actually a Thai monk came in and did this like very emotional, like in Thai, like, "No, the Buddha's going to pass away." Like actually crying and yelling out, "No." And found that that was something that people do as a, like a reenactment of that. But for me, what's coming up is this idea that when you make an aspiration for liberation or an aspiration for Nibbana, it is like saying goodbye. It's like a feeling of saying goodbye, but also at the same time, like a feeling of deciding to finally go home. And that was like a very powerful reflection that was coming up for me at that place. There's also in that same area in the afternoon, we had the opportunity to go to the, it's called the Ramabhar Shrine. It's where the Buddha was cremated. So there's a place where the Buddha passed away, and then there's not too far away the place where the Buddha was cremated. 7 days after he passed away, he was cremated. And there's like a, just like a mound of bricks, kind of roughly in the shape of a person. And it's quite large, like it's just been added to a lot over the years. And I know Lhompho Samedo would say that that's a very profound place for him, where he would go and when he turned 81, he would go and ask forgiveness for living longer than the Buddha. And after that, we crossed the border. We went to Lumbini. In the buses, we did a recitation of 108 ETP-SOs because to try to create some sort of blessings for crossing the border, asking help for crossing the border, because it's understood that nowadays the crossing from India into Nepal is difficult, and there's been some unrest in Nepal, so the border check can be especially stringent. But the chanting did seem to work, and we made it through in almost record time for our group. Yom Lek was saying it could take up to 8 hours to cross the border. It took us about two and a half to three hours, which is about as quick as it could possibly happen. So we were able to go to Lumbini, and that's the place where the Bodhisattva was born. And that's called the Maya Devi Temple. There's like a park and a temple. There's a temple over this archaeological site where they discovered a stone marker that claims it's the exact spot where the Buddha was born. And powerful in its own way. I found each of these sites affects us differently and has a kind of a different energy to it, which is hard to explain. And also the different holy sites would affect people in different ways. So we stayed there for a period of time, and we also have the opportunity to go to Kapilavatthu, where the young Bodhisattva grew up, and also where he left home from. And we had a chance to do some meditation and practice there. And that's where, that for me, that's a powerful site because that's where the renunciation took place. So the leaving home when he was 29 years old and leaving out the East Gate to go and seek the deathless. So another very powerful site. From there, we entered back into India, back across the border. And since Lumbini is so close to the border, we only had a chance to do 9 ETP-SO recitations to prepare ourselves for the border crossing. And there was a, I thought our group was big with 2 buses, but there was a Sri Lankan group. They had 7 buses and they were in the queue in front of us, but they were very kind and we actually got through pretty quickly. So made our way to Savatthi, and this is another place. It's not one of the 4 main holy sites, but it is where the Buddha spent 25 years of his 45-year teaching career. And there's a monastery known as Jetta's Grove in Atapindika's Park. So a lot of the Buddha's teachings, a lot of the suttas are based in this spot, including the Anapanasati Sutta, Mangala Sutta. Actually, Anapanasati took place not in Jetta's Grove, but nearby the hall with the peaked roof, which was also in Savatthi. But in Jetta's Grove is Mangala Sutta. There's also many other suttas that took place there. And so there's a Buddha's Kuti there, and there was monasteries there, not just in the time of the Buddha, but also for hundreds of years afterwards. And we were able to do a large flower offering to the Buddha's Kuti, which I found to be a very joyful experience once we were able to deck out the walls of the foundation walls of the Buddha's Kuti with orange marigolds and yellow marigolds and roses and lotuses. We were able to, all of us had the chance to put piles and piles of flowers around. And I found this kind of this very joyous experience. And we were able to do meditation there through the day. We went back to our nearby hotel, had lunch there, had a bit of a rest, and then we were going to go back to Jetta's Grove. And it's a very nice park, so you could actually, there's lawn areas, there's Bodhi trees, there's places to meditate. But before going back there, we had to visit some nearby spots as well. And there's the Angulimala Stupa, so the mass murderer Angulimala, who converted to be a monk under the Buddha, renounced his ways and became one of the great disciples of the Buddha. There's the monument supposedly containing his bone relics from when he passed away. And it's kind of just off the side of the road. And then across the road from it is Anathapindika's house. And he was the donor of Jetta's Grove and the great patron of the Buddha for a very long time. And so sometimes I find at these sites, you don't expect that a site's going to affect you in a profound way. So I found actually the Angulimala Stupa, I wasn't expecting to be really affected by it at all. And I did a bit of a reading for the group from one of my favorite suttas, the Angulimala Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. And there's the verses of Angulimala at the end. And I think that set me up for having a strong experience while we did some circles where we walk around the stupa three times. And some of those verses in the Angulimala Sutta, he talks about how he's so grateful that he made the decision to follow the Buddha and how that decision wasn't made in vain. And then that because by renouncing killing, by renouncing evil, that he was able to lead a skillful life under the Buddha. And that the verses are the translation is really, I find it's really powerful to read them. So I do recommend that for anybody. Majjhima Nikaya, Angulimala Sutta. But it's saying that decision of mine wasn't made in vain to do what is wholesome and to renounce anything unskillful. And the decision of mine wasn't made in vain. And now I'm absolutely free and the Buddha's teaching has been done. And then after reading that, we did some circumambulation. My hair was just standing on end the whole time, just circling this monument and totally unexpected. And it's kind of the power of like a bad person turning to be good. We always hope for that, but it's so rare. And it's like the power of the Buddha to be able to turn people to the good. It takes that sense of inspiration, faith, confidence. And so the whole, I do recommend for people who don't know about it to look into the story of Angulimala. It's a very good story. And then going to Anathapindika's house, of course, if people want to get rich, they make their aspirations there. So if you want to be a millionaire like Anathapindika, but then there's a lot of stories about him too, because he actually went broke, not just purchasing Jetta's Grove, but also he was so generous in inviting the monks to his home. He would invite the monks and the nuns regularly to have meals in his home. So actually, there was so many meal invitations that he ran out of money again. And according to the stories, the legends, there was like a protector deity who helped him guard his wealth. And the protector deity kind of came to him in some sort of dream or vision saying, "You're going to run out of money. Please just don't do so many meal invitations. You're going to go broke." And then he actually responds to his deity saying, "If I'm going to be poor, let me be poor. It doesn't matter." He can't stop himself from offering meals to the Sangha. So eventually he does grow broke. And then something happens where the deity pairs up with another deity and they find him another source of wealth or so. I can't remember the whole story, but these are the types of stories that get told by the tour guides on these pilgrimages. And then after that, we were able to go back and meditate for the rest of the afternoon in Jetta's Grove. And we were kind of behind the Buddha, set up behind the Buddha's Kuti, although it was freestyle as well. People could go off on their own if they wanted to. And our flower offering was still there. As we walked in, our flower offering was like the scent from the roses and the flowers was kind of wafting towards us. And we were able to sit as a group. And then at the end of the day, they have a closing time at 5:30 PM. And we did some verses of sharing and aspiration, sharing of merit. And as we did that, then the workers came and started sweeping our flower offering away and ready for the next offerings for the next day. And myself, and I think many others, found this to be an extremely profound experience as we were sharing the merit. It was almost like in the sweeping of those flowers, it was like watching them become merit. It was no longer a physical thing, but it was watching it become goodness, watching it go into eternity. And just to be able to make an offering like that is a very rare occasion, can be a very profound experience. So from there, we went then to Salvatita Sarnath, Varanasi. So the next place was where the Buddha gave the first teaching. So the region now is called Varanasi. In the suttas, it's called Benares. But one of our Indian sort of helpers on the bus was actually from Varanasi. And he said many of the locals actually still call it Benares. So this is one of the places where the name hasn't actually changed since the time of the suttas. And it's a 7,000-year-old city. It's been continuously occupied for 7,000 years. And a lot of layers and layers of history and spirituality there. And the Ganges River along the city. So it's about 7 miles away. You have the Deer Park, Sarnath, where the Buddha taught the first five disciples. And you have this kind of impressive monument called the Damek Stupa, which is supposed to mark the exact spot where the Buddha gave the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. And again, just very moving, very powerful. For myself, I was starting to get a bit sick with a lung infection that time, but as we set up for meditation, we had just people bursting into tears more and just being very moved by the sight. We did a couple hours of meditation there, had the chance to go back after the meal and do a bit more practice there before, and it was kind of the end of our loop before going back to Bodh Gaya. And we'd been on the road for 2 weeks then. So then we had a evening where we were able to go on a boat ride on the Ganges River. And that was kind of a nice ending to our pilgrimage loop. One of the things that you get to see when you do a boat ride on the Ganges River is the burning ghats, it's considered one of the holiest places to be burned if you're a Hindu, to be burned on the riverbanks and have your ashes placed in the river. And it's an average of 260 bodies a day get burned at this place. So when you're going down, it's evening time, so you can see the glow of about 12 or 13 fires burning simultaneously. And then going on from there and going to view a large puja that happens every night at 6:30 PM. And it's just very impressive. The Brahmins doing their Vedic hymns, the Vedic chanting, and the drums and cymbals, and thousands of people gathered for it and being really into it. So we stopped, the boat stopped, and we viewed that for a while, and then went back past the burning ghats again and went back to our hotel, got back not too late, got to have some rest before heading back to Bodh Gaya. When we went back to Bodh Gaya, we did nine people left, had only that much time, went back to America, and the rest of us stayed in Bodh Gaya for another week and did a week-long meditation retreat. I'd kind of had this idea to do a meditation retreat in Bodh Gaya because I've done so much meditation with Ajahn Acalo under the Bodhi tree, and I really wanted to share that experience with others, and it did happen that Ajahn Acalo was there doing more meditation. So we did do some group practice, but a lot of it was freestyle, and a lot of people did choose to go and practice near where he was. So I was just so happy that people got to have that experience. But actually, I remember after one day, I was thinking, what was I thinking? A week-long retreat at the Bodhi tree? This is crazy. This is just, there's so many people and there's so much happening and there's so much noise, but it did work. He worked out our tour guide, Yom Lek. She organized this meditation park, which you normally have to pay to get into, but we had a kind of our own area where you could sit as a group if you wanted to. And then if you wanted to go and be closer to the Bodhi tree, you could. We just had our meeting times and our meal times and our breakfast time and our tea time, and people knew where to go to join in with those things. So it was largely freestyle, and it worked. It was great. I was still through this whole trip, and many people know I've been dealing with sciatica, extreme sciatica, for 9 months now. And it's gotten a lot better over those months, but it's still with me and down my left side. And so I haven't been able to sit in meditation for a long time. I've had to do walking meditation, standing meditation. And even till that point, I was having trouble doing sitting. So I was doing a lot of walking around the Mahabodhi temple, not doing much sitting at all. But as the group left, I had planned to stay for another week and was hoping to do more sitting meditation. And the last day that we were all there as a group together, I was able to sit for 2 hours for the first time in 9 months. And it just felt so good to be able to do that and not get shooting pains down my leg. And then the group left, and it was just myself and Ajahn Sikh, and Lehman Chinati stayed back. He kind of last spur of the moment changed his plans, stayed with us, attended to us. And suddenly I was able to sit for 7 hours a day, each day for a week, because I was able to, wanted to do 50 hours of meditation, which doesn't seem like much compared to what I've done there before. But in light of having sciatica, it seemed like a lot, but I was able to do it. And then without much pain, it was almost unbelievable. I was able to fulfill my determination to do that. And I thought, oh, this is amazing. It feels so good to be able to get back into sitting again. And then as I finished my determination, the pain kind of came back, actually. This kind of highlights the power of a determination, perhaps. And then I thought, okay, I'm ready to come back. So a month in India, November 1st to December 1st is long enough. And spend a couple nights in Thailand and come back. So felt like that's kind of a bit of a synopsis of what we did, a bit of a summary. Hoping to do maybe tomorrow or in the coming days, so like a photo montage. There was a lot of good photos taken by some professional photographers and good photos taken by people who were professionals, but still took good photos, and hope to show whoever's interested in the next few days more like what these places look like. So I think just in closing, it's good to say that these are called in Pali, we call them the Chatura Sangwajaniya Sadha. And these are the four places, where the Buddha was born, where he's awakened, where he gave the first teaching, where he passed away. The four places which inspire faith and a sense of urgency in the practice. And anybody who goes to visit them with a heart of faith gains great benefit. So people can see that for themselves. It is self-evident. And again, it is almost unbelievable that we actually pulled it off. We actually did it. And I'm very happy with how it went. So that's a little bit of a summary. I think I'll just leave that for a reflection this evening.